I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. Miami-Dade County has rarely, if ever, faced a budget season more challenging than this one, after last year's budget escaped a $400 million shortfall only after some 11th-hour magic. That budget was $13 billion. The one Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava just presented for the coming year is $14 billion. But slowing revenue growth and rising inflation, not to mention the possibility that Florida voters could approve epic property tax cuts this fall, means the county may have to eliminate jobs and slash spending in areas like transit. That's not the only issue facing Mayor Levine-Cava at the midpoint of her second term. What to do with the Everglades property where the controversial Alligator Alcatraz Migrant Detention Center stood? How to secure that Fisher Island fuel depot to keep the economically vital cruise industry here? How to protect the Haitian and other migrant communities facing the end of their temporary protected status? And how to make Miami-Dade an affordable place to live again? Joining me now is Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava. Mayor, many thanks for giving us your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim.
And if you have questions for the mayor, call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mayor Levine-Cava, let's take a brief look at that $14 billion budget you've presented. What stands out in your mind in terms of its priorities? What gets funded and what gets cut? I know it emphasizes public safety and infrastructure investment, for example, but also public transit reductions and vacant job eliminations. Why on both counts?
So, Tim, as you've pointed out, this was very challenging. We are having to spread the general fund portion of our budget, that which is supported by property tax, further with five constitutional offices now going into their third year. So they all want to increase their spending. And of course, they have costs that are built in. But we had to tighten our belts. We had to go to our departments. We've been working with them for going on 2 years on cost-saving measures through the WISE 305 initiative. And we held them to a very, very slow growth rate, which with the increased costs from gas, cost of buying things, built-in salary increases for our union employees and the like, meant we kept them at 3%. Right. Even though natural growth would have been higher.
And these new constitutional offices include services like the new tax collector office, right?
Correct. Yeah. And our sheriff, our supervisor of elections, property appraiser, and the clerk of the courts.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And again, as I mentioned, you're emphasizing public safety and infrastructure investment. Those two things, I think, stood out for a lot of people. Why?
Well, infrastructure, by the way, is something that was neglected in the past. We have an aging airport, which we've turned around with a $14 billion investment, which is making great progress. Our water and sewer system, which was polluting the bay, we're under federal consent decree to fix all of the infrastructure so we don't leak and we can stay up to speed with that. Certainly transit as well. We've had to do modernization there. You have to take care of things. Yeah. We have been very fortunate to receive a lot of federal funding, especially, and some state funding that has helped us along the way. I want to point out that housing has been another major feature. I'm very painfully aware of the high cost of living.
Right, and we're going to get to that, yeah.
Okay, very good. So those are some of the areas.
But also public transit reductions. I know that's kind of a cause of anxiety for a lot of people, but it may not be as big a cut as perhaps people are anticipating, no?
Well, transit is really a challenge because our fare box revenue is very low relative to the total cost and has always been. So we have not raised our fares in a dozen years. We have a higher than I think any major metropolitan area amount of free or reduced fares. So we have a very generous system. We do have the half penny, which was originally scheduled to be a full penny. And so it was overpromised. And people are still expecting what that full penny would have funded, which sadly, prior to my time, of course, is failing to deliver. So we have been facing a fiscal cliff. We did propose some new revenues last year that were rejected. And there are hard choices here.
Right.
The commission is going to have to decide if they want to preserve the routes, which we have been very careful in which routes we identify to have minimal impact. But for those who depend upon it, of course, it is a hardship. We wish we could afford to maintain all the routes.
Now, you did stress when you presented your budget that revenue for Miami-Dade is slowing and inflation is rising. You suggested the county is facing a real squeeze. As I mentioned, you and the commission seemed to just narrowly escape budget crisis last September. I think I called you Houdini when you were on the show right after that. And there's a sense that this September's budget drama could prove even more daunting. Why?
Well, we took a different approach this year. Last year, we were just getting used to the individual constitutional offices, and we really can't know exactly the funds that they will surplus. They can't surplus dollars. They have to give it back to the general fund. And we said there was a $400 million shortfall because we knew that they'd be bringing some back, but we didn't know how much. In the end, pinching pennies here and there, we were able to balance the budget because, of course, we must. This year, we took a different tact and we said, okay, we've seen the track record. We know what's a reasonable growth. We're taking belt tightening measures. The constitutionals need to do the same. And we predicted, okay, what they would put back in the pot. So we're taking this different approach. If our estimates are wrong on the side of they don't bring as much back to the general fund, then we'll have to find other places to cut. Mm-hmm. If we're right, or even if they put back more in the pot, then we'll have some more flexibility.
Now, I want to go, we have to address the budget elephant in the room, and that is the possibility of Florida voters approving the property tax cut referendum in November. That measure, specifically raising the homestead property tax exemption from $50,000 currently to eventually $250,000, could cost Miami-Dade County almost $400 million in the first year alone. How will that affect services and just the general functioning of county government if it goes through?
Yeah, people obviously are having a hard time making ends meet. We have high inflation. We understand people are struggling. Homeowners can't get insurance that they can afford and the like. So it's very tempting to say, oh, sure, I'll take this tax break. Unfortunately, they also want the services that these dollars provide, whether it's transit or road repair, parks, animal services, libraries, public safety, so much that depends upon that money. So really, they've not been told the truth up until this point. And the county is restricted. All government entities are restricted from lobbying the public about a public referendum. So it has to be the private sector that steps up and makes it known. Now, we can do some estimates of what the impacts are. We've started to do that. We're going to do more. People need to understand what's at stake. And we do believe that when they realize what they'll lose, that they'll reconsider support for a short term, well, a break.
Considering, for example, the fact that, you know, a service that's provided now publicly could end up costing them more if it has to be transferred to private service, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And well, look, they did not come up with an alternative. Cuts to fire, emergency management, I said parks and libraries, and transportation. These are things that people depend upon each and every day. Yeah. If they understand it, I think the polling has started to show that they will not vote in favor of this.
Do you think the fact that Governor DeSantis is not really going to go out and stump for this as hard as we thought he would also will have an effect or an impact on the vote?
Not the governor, not Senator Scott. We have all kinds of former legislators and business leaders already speaking up about it. Mm-hmm. We just need to do our best, and with the help of informed journalists like yourself, we need people to understand what's involved, what's
now,
at stake.
Now, Governor DeSantis and the Republican-controlled legislature that has placed the property tax cut on the ballot insist that much of the impetus for this was what they call inordinate tax revenue levying and wasteful spending by local governments in Florida relative to their populations. Are they right? Either way, Mayor, does it really help your cause when it gets out that Miami-Dade County paid $4,000 for three portrait paintings of former Commissioner Chair Oliver Gilbert when only one of them got used?
Yeah, so let's start with that part of it.
Okay.
That has raised some eyebrows. Look, these are great public servants. It's not unusual for elected leaders to have their portraits hung. This was a commission initiative. It was not part of my administrative agenda. But I will say that we are spending conservatively. We have tightened our belts in my administration. I have been fiscally conservative. I offered and was passed two rollbacks in the millage rate, and we've kept the millage rate flat. So even though the growth is slowing, we are going to live within our means. Of course, we have to.
And we should point out that last year's almost budget crisis had something to do with the fact that you had actually cut property taxes in the run-up to that, no?
Well, you get what you pay for.
Okay, all right. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava about the serious budget challenges ahead, among other pressing issues here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mayor, regarding the subject of county spending that we were just discussing, you recently had to take action to prevent the county's possible purchase of property on Fisher Island that holds a fuel depot that's critical to keeping the cruise industry here. The county looked set to pay $400 million for what a developer had just recently paid $180 million for. So you've stepped in to get it instead through eminent domain. Where do things stand, and how could this all have been avoided in the first place, do you think?
So this is a facility that has been a fuel facility for as long as the port has used fuel.
As a century or more, yeah.
It's a century before people moved into condos on Fisher Island. And come to find out that there is a covenant that restricts it, and a state law that restricts it from being anything other than a fuel depot. So we had no expectation that anything would change. We were not aware that this property was going to be sold to developers. Obviously, they had something different in mind. And the deal was already made by the time we learned about it.
Yeah.
So it was unfortunate, the timing, when the mediation, which we were directed to do mediation. It was my intention originally to move with eminent domain, but the commission wanted us to mediate. And the mediation came to a price that I can't disclose. It's still under confidentiality. So the numbers that have been given are not correct.
Okay.
That to be said, not only did I feel it was too expensive for our needs, and then I learned about the covenant. I learned the fact that, in fact, there would be a very difficult challenge to overcoming the covenant, the state law, the zoning restrictions. So it was not acceptable to me, and we had to take a different direction.
Now, this controversy also resulted in a high-level shakeup of your staff, including your chief operating officer, Jimmy Morales. How has that affected your administration?
Well, we have been doing very well with recruiting a new port director. We have a wonderful, nationally renowned director, Jonathan Daniels. He was just confirmed by our commission, and he was the one who presided in Baltimore after the Francis Scott Keys Bridge was hit. Job of recovering way ahead of what was anticipated, their ability to move cargo through that important port. He comes from a longshoreman background. He's worked at multiple ports around the country. He was at Port Everglades during a flood crisis. So this is a man who knows his way around and is highly lauded. We're very excited for our Newport leadership.
On another important property issue, where do things stand with your proposal to have Miami-Dade County take the land out in the Everglades where the notorious state-run migrant detention center known as Alligator Alcatraz stood until it was closed this summer and sell it to Everglades National Park? Why do you feel that's the best solution?
Before there ever was an immigration detention facility in anyone's imagination, this was a piece of property that's in a critical habitat, part of the Everglades, part of our preserve area. And so I had already started conversations to move it into permanent conservation. This was now disrupted when it was taken over without our approval by the state, and then we know what happened. Fortunately, the state has now vacated the property and removed all that they had created for this detention facility, and it's going to be a process, right? There are many jurisdictions involved. There is an airstrip. The Federal Aviation Administration has to weigh in on that. There is not only state government, but federal government. There's a native tribe, the Miccosukee. There's Collier County, as well as Dade County. So while we are now in charge of access to the property, we're waiting for the state to officially turn over and say they are not officially using it anymore.
Okay.
And after that, we are going to go and make sure what the result of their having occupied it for a year means for the environment.
But you're confident in the end that there will be a sale to Everglades National Park this land?
No, I'm confident that there will be conservation on this property. Exactly the path and who will be the ultimate owner really depends on all of these jurisdictions and all of the negotiations that will take place going forward.
Just real quickly, too, we have a couple of callers, Mayor, who are asking about the status with the Sequarium. They want to know plans for a marina where the Sequarium is. Is that something you can address?
Yeah, so this was a really unusual situation. This was for so many years a facility where marine mammals were kept and with some real concern about their well-being, including the death of Lolita. So I took the effort, the initiative to say, we will close this facility down. And shortly thereafter, guess what? The company declared bankruptcy.
Right, I remember, right.
It created a challenge for us because we truly were not in charge of who would receive this property. It was up to the bankruptcy court to determine. And mm-hmm. So they did determine. And of course, now we have a developer who was awarded. It's a lease, however. It does have to be approved by the commission. And the commission directed us to negotiate, which mm-hmm. of course we've started to do. We're not there yet. There's definitely been public input and public concern, and it will ultimately be reviewed by our environmental experts as well, okay, as far as the impacts on the natural environment.
Now, I don't think we can talk about the state of Miami-Dade County, though, without mentioning our affordability crisis. This week, Bloomberg reported that the overall cost of living in the Miami metropolitan area is now higher than the New York City regions. Will that provide more impetus for affordable housing here, for example, as you mentioned at the top of our conversation? But are the county's new budget realities an obstacle to that?
I have made housing affordability a priority since I came into office. We declared a housing crisis in 2021. We have put unprecedented amounts of county funding into housing, and we've been successful in already completing in my tenure over 10,000 units of affordable and workforce and 18,000 in the pipeline. And we've identified county properties that can be developed at a lower cost because of county property for at least another 5,000. So we are well on our way. That to be said, no, it's not enough. And it is something that is very much in my heart. We cannot afford to lose our residents. We need our young people to live here. We need our seniors to afford to retire comfortably here. And we will not take our foot off the gas, so to speak. As far as will it create more momentum? Look, the market is very challenging because we have still a big demand for higher cost housing.
Yeah.
And we need to incentivize our builders even more to address it. We do have a great cadre of affordable and workforce developers, and they are eager to develop, and we are eager to support them and move the projects quickly.
Finally, Mayor, I know you've been vocal calling for an extension of temporary protected status, or TPS, for Haitians here, but does it look like their protections from deportation will end next week? And if so, what can the county do to help them at this point?
My heart is breaking. These are hardworking people who've been here so many for many years, legally contributing taxes, opening businesses, fueling our healthcare, education, so many industries. And we're really in a tailspin economically, as well as from a humanitarian perspective. We know going back to Haiti is simply not an option. It's outrageous that we're already deporting people to Haiti, where we're not allowing visitors. It's on a level four status. Don't travel. Leave your DNA samples and teeth records behind in case it's your corpse that returns. It's so shameful. So we have 95% of our Haitian TPS holders employed, up to 350,000 people affected, a tremendous impact on their lives, on Haiti, and on our economy. So still in the Senate's hand. They can still vote today to extend TPS.
Daniela Levine Cava is the mayor of Miami-Dade County. Mayor, as always, many thanks.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, what are the effects as our important Haitian community faces that end of TPS and the start of deportations? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court gave President Trump the green light to end temporary protected status, or TPS, for some 350,000 Haitians living in the U.S., leaving them vulnerable to imminent deportation back to the violent gang rule of Haiti. The Trump administration was sent to end TPS for Haitians today. Wednesday night, however, a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. said it could not be ended until July 27th. It's a short reprieve, but any reprieve helps. If Haitian TPS is canceled on Monday, two large and distressing issues arise. First, what sort of traumatic effect will our community feel when hundreds of thousands of people, many who have lived, worked, built businesses, and raised families here for 15 years or more, face expulsion to the continuing nightmare in Haiti? And how will sectors of Florida's economy that have come to rely on them, especially our vital home health care industry, already dealing with a labor shortage, manage without them? As always, we'd like to hear your thoughts, especially if your family is confronting this crisis. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Haitian community leader Dr. Gerda Nicolas. She's a psychologist and professor at the University of Miami School of Education and Human Development, as well as co-founder of the nonprofit IET Community Trust. Also with us is Laura Morel, a reporter for Mother Jones, who wrote this week about the acute economic impact the end of Haitian TPS could have here. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
Gerda Nicolas, I want to start here with a clip of a conversation I had yesterday with a civic leader in Port-au-Prince named Louis Henry Mars, who gave me this assessment about the possibility of hundreds of thousands of Haitians here being sent back there.
It doesn't really make sense. You know, 85% of the capital is still in the hands of the gangs. They have replaced the state, and the roads out of Port-au-Prince are still controlled by them. And the West Department, the Artibonite Valley, and the Center Department are under almost total control of the gangs. So it's a tremendous ask. A country that's already has 1.5 million refugees in the streets and in makeshift camps, to say that you're going to add another 350,000, it's a nightmare.
Gerda, I remember you and I once talking about the psychological trauma of the 2010 Haiti earthquake. That was the original reason for extending TPS to Haitians here, to shield them for deportation back to that tragedy. and the gang rule nightmare Lewis Henry Mars just described there is the other. Is the cancellation of TPS a potential trauma itself, given what Haitians here will probably have to go back to?
Yes, thank you so much, Tim. Thank you so much for the invitation. Absolutely, right? The termination of TPS is not simply an immigration policy change. For many people, it is potentially traumatic disruption for their entire lives. So that, as you said, the 2010 earthquake was the original emergency that led to TPS, but Haitians have experienced layered upon layers of crisis since then. Political instability, natural disasters, economic hardship, displacement, and now extraordinary high levels of violence and insecurity. Haiti remains under a national state of emergency, as you mentioned, and the U.S. government itself continued to advise Americans not to travel there because of a number of issues. So many TPS holders now who live in the United States for more than a decade. They have jobs, as you heard the mayor mention. They have homes, businesses, churches, and children who are not U.S. citizens. The possibility of suddenly losing employment authorization, being separated from one's children, or being returned to a country where it clearly doesn't feel safe for many, it absolutely can create an intense anxiety, grief, helplessness, and anticipatory trauma. We should also remember that the trauma extends beyond the individual TPS holder. Sure. Children are hearing conversations about deportation and wondering whether or not a parent will disappear. Spouses are making impossible decisions about whether or not to separate the family. Employers, churches, schools, entire communities are also experiencing this uncertainty. Right. I can tell you myself, over the last 3 weeks, I had to deal with about a little bit over a dozen intimate partner violence situations, because when people feel helpless, violence increases. And there are about 8 suicide attempts that I also had to deal with as well. So that is why we must treat this not only as an immigration issue, but as a family stability and public right. health and mental health and a humanitarian issue.
So Gerda, how should Haitian TPS holders and their families here be preparing, psychologically and otherwise, for what comes next? What steps, if any, should they be taking to minimize, if not prevent altogether, this upheaval you're just describing?
The first recommendation, Tim, is to not panic, but not to maintain paralyzed either. So fear can make people avoid open letters, consulting an attorney, and have difficulty with having family conversations. So preparing helps restore a sense of control. So every TPS holder should obtain an individualized legalized consultant from a qualified immigration attorney or accredited legal representative. So people should not assume that TPS is their only possible protection. All right. So families should also protect themselves from misinformation and immigration schemes. So that's one. The second thing I would say, that family needs to have a written preparedness plan, right? That right. includes organizing all your stuff, your passport, birth certification, immigration stuff, medical information, and so forth. Third is around protecting yourself, protecting your mental health. So staying connected to your trusted family members, your faith communities, the mental health providers, other community organizations, because it's normal to feel frightened and overwhelmed, but no one should carry that fear alone.
Right.
No. So we also, the other thing I would say is that we are developing a very coordinated return integration process for those who have to return to Haiti or decide to return home. So we want people to know that they're not alone during this process.
Okay.
To Haiti Community Trust and a number of our partners like Buzz Inc., Haiti Health Network, we have created a whole system that people can use to kind of get reliable information about and resources about what's going back home.
No, that's really good to know. Laura Morell, your Mother Jones article this week made it fairly clear that there's a broader upheaval involved here, and that's the impact the end of Haitian TPS will have on the Florida economy, especially in areas like home health care. What were your key findings in your report?
Yes, hi. Thanks again for having me on the show. So in terms of what I found in my reporting, so as you mentioned earlier, there's 350,000 approximately TPS holders from Haiti in the U.S. About half of those are in Florida, and of those, about 35,000 work in the healthcare industry. A lot of these are people that are caring for the elderly, that are caring for people with special needs. We're talking about home health aides, CNAs, and nurses, and other kinds of positions in the medical field. And if these people lose their ability to work, which seems likely next week, it will further impact the current staffing shortage that much of the healthcare sector is already experiencing. And it's also detrimental to patients themselves who might end up in a higher level of care.
Right.
So there's also this emotional component of it too, where healthcare workers and patients have, you know, developed relationships over time. So there's lots of impacts just in the healthcare industry specifically.
Right. Now, Laura, you point out in your article that Florida actually ranks last among U.S. states in the availability of home healthcare workers, and that at many nursing homes in South Florida, a third of the workers are TPS holders. And yet Florida has the nation's fastest growing elderly population. So are we looking at a perfect storm here?
We are. The healthcare workforce, in particular for workers that care for the elderly, never truly recovered after the COVID-19 pandemic. There's still incredible staffing shortages. There's still a super competitive labor market. I've spoken to workers who currently right now work at nursing homes and are caring for, you know, at the minimum 10 people during day shifts and sometimes 20 patients during night shifts. So what happens when they are no longer able to work? And it's been very concerning, you know, for the healthcare industry. My story points out that the Florida Healthcare Association, which represents hundreds of nursing homes and ALFs around the state, actually reached out to the Department of Homeland Security, urging them to consider an exemption for healthcare workers because, as they put it, it would cause a ripple effect that would overwhelm hospitals and the healthcare system.
Yeah. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Gerda Nicola of the University of Miami and the IET Community Trust and Laura Morell of Mother Jones about the pending expiration of temporary protected status, or TPS, for Haitians and its potentially traumatic effects in our community. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Gerda Nicola, we're still waiting to see if either the courts or the U.S. Senate, still at the 11th hour, might take some action on this question of TPS expiration for Haitians. But I want to touch on one of the big issues in that Supreme Court ruling that has opened the door to this, which was whether anti-Haitian racism has played a role in the administration's decision. In the larger picture, is that an added trauma for Haitians in all of this?
Absolutely. Yes, it is. It creates what we might call, Tim, dignity injury, which is a deep sense that people are not simply losing a legal status, but being told that their lives, their contribution, their safety are somewhat less worthy of protection. The Supreme Court's decision allowed the administration to proceed with this termination of TPS, you know, and of Haitians and Syrians. The majority rejected the legal challenge while this decision and raised evidence of discriminatory motivation. So for Haitians, this cannot be separated from a longer history of anti-Blackness, anti-immigrant rhetoric, and the unequal treatment of Haitian migrants.
Well, specifically, for example, the remarks President Trump made about Haitians, quote, eating people's pets in Ohio, that sort of thing. And then the minority in the Supreme Court did point out that, look, that has to be taken into account when we judge the administration's decision. Yes?
Absolutely. But when people repeatedly hear their community described like that, as dangerous, as what you just mentioned, undeserving, all of that has a psychological impact. It can produce humiliation, anger, isolation, and a feeling of being rejected by a country where many have worked, paid taxes, cared for patients, as you just heard Laura mention, raised children, and contributed for years. It can especially be painful for the Haitian children and young adults. They may be internalizing the message that there's something wrong with being Haitian, Black, or immigrant.
Right.
And that is why we in the community, leaders and parents, must actively counter these messages. We must remind our community that losing a government designation does not mean losing one's dignity or value.
Right.
Haitians are not disposable, Tim. They are caregivers, they are educators, right. They're healthcare professionals and so forth. And we must make sure that that message gets out so that it doesn't have the psychological impact that we know it can.
Laura Morrell, you know, Mother Jones is often described as a liberal publication, but your article about the impacts of ending Haitian TPS actually read more like an advisory to the more conservative interests of the Florida business community, and not just because the loss of Haitian TPS holders will affect industries like home elder care, but because, as you point out, they contribute an estimated $2.6 billion to the Florida economy. Many are business owners themselves. Are business leaders speaking up at all, do you think?
Yes, business leaders are speaking up in Florida. In fact, there was a press conference, I believe, earlier this week in Miami that included a lot of business leaders from that community. Democrats and Republicans in Congress are speaking up. They've tried so far, you know, unsuccessfully to pass legislation to extend TPS. Healthcare groups, as I mentioned, are also, you know, trying to raise awareness about the implications of this decision. And we've heard from, you know, just the mayor a little while ago in Miami-Dade. So for sure, the end of TPS goes beyond the incredible impacts and harm that it will cause to the Haitian community. Those impacts will also be reflected in so many other parts of Florida and beyond as well.
Laura Morrell is a reporter for Mother Jones. Gerda Nicolas, Dr. Gerda Nicolas, is a professor at the University of Miami School of Education and Development and co-founder of the IET Community Trust. Thank you to you both. Thank you, Gerda. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a great one.
Still to come, the first American film shot entirely in communist Cuba by a South Florida director. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. All summer, those of us who cover Cuba have been asking, is President Trump going to order a U.S. military strike on the communist country to force regime change? Well, a new movie set in Cuba, Havana Coyotes, opens with an imagined invasion of Cuba, but it's the backdrop for a much more personal story about a Miami Cuban American who travels to Havana to collect her grandmother's ashes and connect with her father's birth island while becoming involved with Cubans who want to get off it. Here's a clip.
Look how we live now, in a broken system with little hope. That's why so many young people leave.
It's strange to hear you say that, considering you don't want to.
It's my country. I like living here. I'm happy. I choose to be happy in the midst of all the crap.
Directed by South Florida filmmaker Benjamin Orifici, Havana Coyotes is the first American movie shot entirely on location in communist Cuba with an all-Cuban cast. It explores Cuba's decay, of course, but also the complicated and often resentful relationship between Cubans here and Cubans there. It's a refreshing, candid drama that's been shown at film festivals from Fort Lauderdale to Manhattan. Joining me now is Havana Coyotes director, writer, and producer Benjamin Orifici, who is also a professor of film at Lynn University in Boca Raton. Benjamin, how are you?
I'm good, Tim. Good to be here. Thank you.
If you want to join our conversation, call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Benjamin, you're a South Floridian, but you're actually Italian-American. How did you come to creating an independent film that so intimately explores the Cuban and Cuban-American experience?
Yeah, that's true. My grandparents immigrated from southern Italy to New York City, and I grew up with the flavors and stories of the old country from them. So I do understand to some extent the immigrant experience through that. I first started visiting Havana in 2015 with a Cuban cultural foundation I'm a board member of. And after 20 plus visits, I kind of realized how little the Cuba story that I encountered was really known in the US. And this film wasn't about speaking for Cubans, it's about listening to them. I really wanted to tell a story that respected both the pain of exile and the realities of people still living on the island. Mm-hmm. So ultimately I think Havana Coyotes is less about politics and more about family, memory, and kind of the search where we belong.
So as I mentioned, this is the first American film shot entirely on location in Cuba since the 1959 Communist Revolution with an all-Cuban cast. But given the economic collapse there, especially the chronic blackouts, for example, how hard was it to film there? What were the biggest obstacles? But for that matter, what were some of the cinematic advantages too?
Yeah, that's a great question. This was certainly the most challenging production I've ever undertaken. We filmed in the summer of 2024, and even back then, Cuba was experiencing daily rolling electricity blackouts. We actually had a schedule neighborhood by neighborhood of the times when the cutoffs would happen, but it really wasn't that reliable. So getting actors and crew to set every day was really challenging with transportation. Every day required flexibility.
Yeah.
We encountered storms and illness, but it was really those same realities that gave the film something that, I don't know, we couldn't really create ever on a sound stage.
Yeah, and I have to point out, your cinematography does capture both the beauty and the dilapidation of Havana.
Thank you. I really wanted to show both sides. And, you know, honestly, Havana, in its dilapidation, there is such beauty in these buildings, the old colonial structures. But unfortunately, yes, it's just going without repair.
Yeah.
And really difficult. But I'm sorry, Tim.
And no, and likewise, what were the challenges and benefits of casting the film there?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was really one of the joys. Through a wonderful casting director in Cuba, we were able to get very prominent Cuban actors in the film and television industry. And they really brought their life experiences and perspective to the film. They didn't simply just, let's say, perform the script. Through our rehearsals and discussions, you know, they enriched it. They were super excited to make this film because they really believed in the message.
Mm-hmm. Why the title Havana Coyotes? Explain how that term underpins the plot, if not the theme of the film.
Yeah, Havana Coyotes has several meanings. First and foremost, a coyote, as many of us know, is a smuggler of humans. You know, most, even to this day, Cubans don't need a visa to get to Nicaragua. So if they can afford the plane ticket and they can pay for the coyote in Nicaragua, they will help smuggle them across Latin America through the jungle to Mexico and eventually to the United States. And this is the route many Cubans take. But also the animal coyote is a carnivore by nature. And the relationships in this film between Julia, the Miami Cuban American, and the three Cuban contemporaries, they possess this trait. They're sort of feeding off each other.
Right.
There's a love triangle, there's a secret plan, which is eventually revealed.
Yeah, at one point, the character Julia asks, "Hey, is this all a setup?"
Right. Yes, she was wise to it. You know, she sort of falls in love with one of these Cuban contemporaries, but she realizes there's something underpinning this.
Right, and which has to do with their desire to get off the island.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and you know, they try very hard and, you know, all good laid plans. There's always issues that come in the way. But yes,
right.
She's aware of that.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Benjamin Orefici, director of Havana Coyotes, the first American film shot entirely in communist Cuba. Benjamin, one of the really refreshing qualities of Havana Coyotes is its honesty, not just about the way Cubans talk about their failed communist regime, but how they talk about the U.S. and especially the Cuban diaspora in the U.S. There's one remark a Cuban character makes to the Cuban-American Julia that really struck me. I mean, and it's to the effect, you say up there that you're punishing Cuba because you don't want to support the regime, but who is it you're really not supporting?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So, of course, we live in South Florida, and there are lots of different feelings toward Cuba. And the question really sits, you know, at the heart of this film. I wasn't interested in making a movie that just hands the audience simple political answers. Cuba, as we all know, is much more complicated than that. So yes, the Cuban government bears responsibility for failed economic policies, but at the same time, the decades of US sanctions have imposed real costs on ordinary Cubans and really haven't produced the kind of political transformation they were intended to achieve. So, you know, who are we not supporting, right? We're not giving maybe to the government, but we're also hurting ordinary Cubans who are trying to live. As you know, yeah. Right now they're facing, you know, their greatest difficulties since the Soviet Union departed in the early 90s.
Right, the special period, right. But the real plot dynamic in Havana Coyotes is the intersection of the desire of the Cuban-American Julia to bond with her family's homeland and the desire of the Cuban characters like Olivia and Carlos to get out of that collapsed and repressive homeland. A poignant device you use to convey those emotions is a narrated letter from the dead grandmother whose ashes Julia has come to collect. But what do you hope the film gets across to people, especially at this moment when Cuba may be, as you just pointed out, headed for big change?
Yeah, you know, they call this period the new special period.
Right.
Always using euphemisms. So, yeah, for me, the film is ultimately about inheritance. You know, we inherit stories from our families, from politics, from history. Julia arrives believing she perhaps already understands Cuba because she inherited a version from her father in exile from Operation Peter
Pan. A father who was part of the, as a child, part of the Operation Peter Pedro Pan, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but through this grandmother's letter and the relationship she forms on the island, she realizes the inheritance is just the beginning. So, you know, I hope audiences leave with less certainty and a little more empathy. You can love your homeland and still recognize its failures. You can choose to leave and still mourn what you've left behind. These aren't contradictions to me. They're really part of the human experience.
Right. Finally, Benjamin, there's that fictional military invasion of Cuba that's going on in the background as the personal dramas play out in the film. As I said, that couldn't be more timely at this moment, but why did you include that? And who's doing the invading?
Oh, gosh, yes. So like I said, we filmed this in 2024. And really, honestly, at the time, we thought the invasion felt, quite frankly, a bit fanciful. But because of the film shooting restrictions, we were really working in private locations with the principal cast. I wanted to place the characters under more pressure. And so this invasion portion was created. Honestly, through the past months, this past year really of looking at the film at festivals, it just seems so prescient to me and really has a whole new meaning with what is going on right now.
Right.
Yeah, who's invading and who is helping? I think I'll leave that to the viewers to decide.
Sure. Okay.
But I want it to be a sort of a hopeful message. So in the film, okay, who is coming to the rescue is something that hopefully had a hopeful stance.
Right. Yeah. Benjamin Orefici is the director, writer, and producer of the film Havana Coyotes. Benjamin, many thanks.
Thank you, Tim. Pleasure to be here.
Finally, on the South Florida Roundup, flamingos may not yet officially be Florida's state bird, but now they are Miami-Dades. This week, the Miami-Dade Commission made flamingos the first among the county's fine-feathered friends. The pink birds, with their long legs and elegant curled necks, are native to Florida, but they faced near extinction a century ago from the plume trade. Today, they're making a comeback. Many actually got blown here from the Caribbean by Hurricane Idalia 3 years ago. And they're mostly found in the Everglades, Biscayne Bay, and the Florida Keys, not to mention Zoo Miami, the Hialeah Park Casino, and those hip opening credits to the old Miami Vice TV show. Thank you to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the flamingo bird call. And thank you for listening to the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Chris Young. Denise Royal is the senior producer of content streaming and news products. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is WLRN's digital director. Sergio Bustos is our vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.